Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. There are many more podcasts for this and all of our other faith radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
9 minutes after the hour. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to have Paul Perreault do the heavy lifting this morning, talking to David Aikman. That's going to give me an opportunity to sit here quietly and try to listen to see if that accent is real or not. Paul, take it away.
All right, thanks, Bill, and thanks for joining us for Dr. Bill Meyer Live. Joining us on the phone line right now is longtime friend of the show, Dr. David Aikman. David Aikman, the former professor of history at Patrick Henry College and a longtime journalist, Time Magazine, among others. Hey, Dr. Aikman, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I've been wanting to get you on because you, as we can tell by your voice, are not a native North American. You are from the great island of Britain, and obviously you have some thoughts about the Brexit vote, which turned out, in the end, people, by a slight majority, saying, let's leave the EU. Now, I want to ask you, when you read that Friday morning, what was your first reaction?
Well, it was that the Leave campaign had finally reached a point of momentum where a majority, albeit a slight majority, but definitely a majority of Britons, recognized the arguments that the disadvantages of staying in the EU far outweighed the possible risks of leaving. So it was a demonstration of faith and hope in the British tradition of self-government that was, I think, vindicated by the result.
Well, as part of that, I mean, a lot of people are going, okay, what's the financial results? And we saw on Friday, and we may see it again today, with the British pound dropping, the stock markets worldwide reeling. Do you think this is just kind of a temporary thing, or will this kind of work itself out, or will it be long-term?
No, I do think it's a temporary thing. I mean, obviously, there are going to be major adjustments necessary because the rules of the EU will not apply to Great Britain anymore. But I don't think the substantive situation of British economic realities is so vulnerable that, let's face it, Britain's economy is the fifth largest in the world. It has had the most successful economic performance of all the European Union countries for the last several years. So Britain must be doing something right. And the idea that by disentangling itself from Europe, it's going to go through all these hiccups and unexpected changes, I don't think holds true.
Well, that brings up a question. How long will it take for Great Britain to be thoroughly disentangled from the EU? This is not something that can just happen overnight, can it?
No, indeed not. In fact, it may take a couple of years to untie all of the ties that bind Britain to the EU. I mean, there are a lot of bureaucratic things that will have to take place. But the fundamental principle of this vote is that British people felt that by being in the EU, they were tying themselves in bureaucratic knots that was harming the economy, changing the cultural values of the country by making possible an absolutely unimpeded influx of migrants from backgrounds completely incompatible with the British political and cultural way of life. And The general situation had become a nightmare for most British people, even aside from the immigration debate. I mean, it's remarkable the Leave campaign had wonderful examples of people complaining that they were being told by Brussels what size tea kettle they could safely have in their homes. Yeah, well, European Union regulations said, well, you can't have a label for fish sauce that is 2 inches high instead of 3 inches high. I mean, these kinds of idiotic regulations, you can't even have an outhouse of a certain color because the European Union says outhouses all have to be beige or something like that. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but the sense of an unelected bureaucracy for utopian purposes of control, directing the activities of the citizens of a country which basically invented democracy back with the Magna Carta, this has come home to roost. And I think it's an extraordinary rebellion against bureaucracy.
As you mentioned, Great Britain, the fifth largest world economy, and that's a big chunk of the EU. What's going to happen in your mind? What do you think is going to happen with the EU? Is it at risk?
Well, I think the EU is in danger, and it was in danger well before Brexit happened, of falling apart under its own dead weight, because it has set up a system of bureaucratic controls and welfare benefits and so forth that it is completely unable to satisfy with the economic performance of the Union as a whole. And it's trying to create a sort of utopian. I mean, it's an admirable ideal. The EU was started basically with economic experiments of cooperation after World War II to bring the French and the Germans and the Belgians together so that there could never be another war in Europe again. Admirable ideal and objective. But the problem is, as the economic benefits developed and proved themselves, it then started to move to the unwritten subtext of the European Union agreements, which was eventually for a political union. In other words, the European Union was assuming that eventually all of the European members of it could comprise a supranational state. And that was based on a complete philosophical misunderstanding of reality, indeed of human nature. If you go back to the American Revolution and the construction of the Constitution, what you find at heart is a profound awareness of the innate evil in human beings and the need to protect society from too much power falling into the hands of any one person or one group. And so the protections of the American Constitution are based on a completely realistic assessment of the fallibility of human beings. The European project, by contrast, was based on a secular utopian understanding of what human organizations could accomplish if they simply got the right ideas together. And I think the Brexit vote is as much a philosophical rejection of European utopianism as it is as the need to express political independence.
Interesting. One more question on the Brexit topic. What do you think there would be, if any, implications on the church in Europe, especially in Britain?
Well, that's a very good question, because the Brexit vote touches upon one of the keys of European Christian development, which was not just the Reformation, but the emergence after the Reformation of strong currents of religious freedom, which eventually morphed into what became the Puritan Revolution in Britain, and then, of course, developed into American constitutional ideas on the other side of the Atlantic. But those great American constitutional ideas all grew out of the sense of obligation to have one's conscience open to the Almighty, to be able to express one's worship in one any way possible. That formed the basis of the idea of individual rights underlying American democracy at the outset.
All right. We're talking with Dr. David Aikman. We're going to take a break. When we come back, a look at some recent news involving ISIS and the UN. Stay with us on Dr. Bill Maier Live. Thanks again for listening to Dr. Bill Meyer Live. I'm Paul Perreault, helping out this morning and talking with Dr. David Aikman, who is, again, a journalist of many years, as well as former history professor at Patrick Henry College. And last week, among the things that happened, this not as big in the news, but the implications are huge. There was a meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Council, and at that meeting, the American Center for Law and Justice, as well as its European counterpart, the European Center for Law and Justice, presented a very, very pointed message to the UN Human Rights Council, do something about ISIS. Now, as you reviewed the news about that, Dr. Aikman, what were some of your initial thoughts?
Well, the UN had accurately wanted to label ISIS a genocidal organization because of its attempt to overcome the Yazidis, a minority group in Syria and Iraq. But as the American Center of Law and Justice pointed out, the attacks upon Christians had also constituted genocide because Christians had been murdered purely on the basis of the fact that they would not convert to Islam. Now, the UN at first rejected the labeling of genocide on ISIS because of this, because the UN said, well, Christians can stay in ISIS-dominated areas as long as they pay the jizya tax, which is part of Sharia law that people of other faiths who live under Islamic control must pay a tax or convert. Well, this is a form of extortion and I don't know what it is, real deployment of power without control that is completely unacceptable. And it is basically saying any Islamic state that allows Christians to stay as long as they pay jizya tax is okay. But we know places like Saudi Arabia that don't allow any Christians at all to live. So the fact that Islamic states overall, not just the organization ISIS, are putting this kind of coercion on Christian minorities who live there really has to be exposed for what it is, a discrimination against people of other faiths than Islam.
Why the reluctance? Why the reluctance on the UN's part to even consider? I mean, you said, oh, they can just pay the tax. Why the reluctance to identify it as genocide?
Well, because the UN is a highly secular organization that is politically correct, that responds to the fleeting of Muslims who complain that any criticism of Islam amounts to Islamophobia, and it's one of the worst crimes in the world to make an insult to the Prophet Muhammad, etc. The complete distortion of values of right and wrong, of freedom and tolerance, and the refusal to accept that the premise of secularity, with exceptions, of course, for about Muslims, is a total anomaly and a transgression of common sense and decency. And I think it shows the hollowness of the entire UN Human Rights Council activity over the last several years.
To me, it's interesting, too, because, okay, why have there been so many refugees over the last 2-3 years from Syria and Iraq? These are people fleeing for their lives many times, whether it be talking Yazidis, Christians, or even just Muslims who don't agree with the ISIS mode of doing things. It's religious persecution. That's what's causing the fleeing. And there's a direct tie to this genocide issue and the whole refugee crisis, isn't there?
Of course there is, and it's the unwillingness to accept the reason that all the refugees are fleeing by the UN that explains the reluctance of their using the term genocide specifically because of the actions against Christians. They don't want to face up to the reality of what is going on in the Middle East.
Do you see any way that we, the average Joe and Jane citizen here in the United States, can offer hope, help, pressure on the UN?
Well, I think what we have to do is to put pressure on our own elected representatives to speak up for the truth, to have representatives of the U.S. in UN forums who speak the truth and contradict this malevolent nonsense about the jizya and sharia, etc. And we have to put every pressure we can on our own authorities to do the right thing in regard to the persecuted minorities around the world.
Hey, Dr. Aikman, thanks again for joining us on Dr. Bill Maier Live. Always, always appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Maier Live. If you'd like more information about this show, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com.